Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the declassified NSA surveillance documents that indicate the government went too far in collecting domestic phone data and misled the FISA court, prompting a rebuke of the NSA from a judge on the secret court that oversees the intelligence community's secrets. Cindy Cohn, the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which along with the ACLU sued to get the documents released, joins us. Then we will speak with Lynn Bartels, who is a journalist with the Denver Post who has been covering the recall elections in Colorado that resulted in the recall of two Democratic state senators who voted for tighter gun control laws after the massacres in Aurora, Colorado and Newtown, Connecticut. We will discuss the national political significance of this victory for the NRA, which was outspent 6-1 by pro-gun control opponents of the recall in spite of personal contributions of $350,000 by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and $250,000 from Los Angeles philanthropist Eli Broad. Then finally, we will look into the chaos in Syria and the broader Middle East, and the historical legacy of colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism, with the author of a new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Scott Anderson, a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, and El Salvador, joins us to discuss the roots of the current turmoil in which he sees the Arab world continuing to be defined less by what it aspires to become and more by what it is opposed to. And joining us now is Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cindy Cohn.
Thank you.
The last time we spoke, Cindy, was when you filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the National Security Agency in federal court in San Francisco. And it looks as if that lawsuit, which the ACLU joined, has borne fruit.
Well, we certainly have borne fruit in our Freedom of Information Act work, which was an earlier lawsuit. The lawsuit, I think, that we filed last time we spoke was about the attempt to try to stop the spying. The ACLU and the EFF had earlier lawsuits trying to get the government to release its legal opinions that the surveillance was legal, and the court opinions as well. And that's what bore fruit yesterday. So I know it's complicated. There's a lot of things going on. But the Freedom of Information Act work that we did is actually a couple years old. And finally, yesterday, the government coughed up a bunch of documents, although I don't think we're done yet.
And these relate to a time in 2009 when the NSA went too far in collecting phone data, domestic phone data, and then on top of that they misled the FISA court about what they were doing.
Exactly.
So I find it extraordinary that these rulings or these rebukes from the FISA court judges are themselves classified top secret.
Yes, I think it's a tragedy, really, because essentially what we have is a tremendous body of secret law, including, you know, secret court analysis about how the government has been systematically violating our rights with this collection. I think it's shameful.
So, first of all, there's an enormous paradox, or in fact an oxymoron here, that you have a secret court. That in itself is an oxymoron, because courts are supposed to be open to the public and testimony is supposed to be open. So that's the first piece of Orwellian logic, that you have a secret court. The second piece seems to be that there is no person who's an advocate for the American people or for the accused or for the defendants. It's all the prosecution. In other words, the only people who get to present evidence in this court are the government itself. So there's nobody there. There's no checks and balance. So the judges have to rely on government evidence alone. Isn't that the way it works?
That's correct. And the chief justice, the chief judge of the secret court right now, a judge named Reggie Walton in Washington, D.C., has even spoken publicly to the Washington Post about this, about how the court is essentially completely beholden to the government to do its own self-analysis and report to the court what it finds, and there's only one voice. And you can see in these decisions, in the filings that go back and forth between the government and the court, is that you know, the court really is at a huge disadvantage in trying to do some kind of oversight over this agency, because the only information it gets is from the agency itself, and it's all very carefully spun to present the government's actions in the best possible light. And they don't have any counterbalance there. And that's the basis for a lot of proposals to try to bring some reform here. You know, we understand that national security efforts of the government are going to have some amount of secrecy, but creating a significantly more transparency than what we have now, plus a more fair process, is on the minds of some congressmen, and we certainly think it's long overdue.
And one of the declassified documents is Judge Walton's rebuke to the NSA, where he basically saying that the privacy safeguards that the court has approved, the very guidelines that the NSA is supposed to operate under, quoting, have been so frequently and systematically violated that they never functioned effectively. And again, this is a judge that's hamstrung by the deck being stacked in the government's favor. And my understanding is that Chief Justice John Roberts has basically chosen almost all of these judges who've passed a very conservative judge's litmus test.
Well, the judges are picked by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. So before Roberts, it was Justice Rehnquist. So there's been a more conservative member of the judiciary hand picking all of the judges for a very long time now. I think that is problematic as well. When the FISA law was passed, it was an attempt to try to create some kind of rule of law over the government's national security spying. Remember, the FISA law was passed after the last time the national security apparatus of the United States was caught spying on innocent Americans. And it's clear that law has some flaws in it. It did create a basic rule of law over national security surveillance, but it plainly isn't the right fit now, and I'm not sure it ever was, for what needs to be done to make sure that, you know, there isn't a national security exception to the United States Constitution. Our rights don't have a national security exception. Some countries in the world do have national security exceptions to their constitutional rights, but ours does not. And it appears that this secret court with secret law, just hearing from the government, has created some form of a national security exception to our constitutional rights, and we need to fix that.
And again, I'm speaking with Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. So, in terms of the 14 documents that were just released by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, on the DNI's website, what else is there apart from these letters of rebuke from this secret court to the NSA, basically saying, you know, you've overstepped your bounds, and this particularly refers to the collection of intelligence back in 2009, where only about 10% of the 17,800 phone numbers on this so-called alert list that they have for tracking foreign terrorists here in the United States met the tests and the guidelines that were laid down by this court.
Well, that's right, and it was discovered in 2009. Actually, it was admitted in 2009 by the government. But you know, it at the time, it's very clear from the papers that this had been going on for years, several years, before the government fessed up to the FISA court. Now, they claim that's when they discovered it, but you know, I'd like to learn a little more. I mean, the things that are still missing are pretty significant, like the court order from the FISA that originally authorized this kind of mass collection, right? This mass collection that government claims was authorized by the court. But we still do not have the judicial ruling that I think was issued in 2006 that authorized this in the first place. How did the court come to decide that they could do this mass collection in the first place? I mean, right now, we're all bogged down in the problems with the mass collection and how it really wasn't nearly as safe as the government admitted it to be. But let's go back to first principles. Actually, sorry, it was 2004. It looks like it was in May of 2004 that the FISA court first authorized this bulk surveillance. And, you know, we need to decide as a country whether we think bulk surveillance is okay. And simply dancing around the edges of when the government has actually misused the power and its own procedures, while that's important, you know, we need to step back a step and say, well, should the government have this at all? Is it constitutional for them to get it at all? And we do not have the court's ruling on that fundamental decision.
And much of this, of course, is what we've seen lately and what you've managed to extract from the government through the Freedom of Information on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Cindy Cohen has been provoked by Edward Snowden. I mean, there's no question that we wouldn't be having this debate but for him.
That's absolutely true. I mean, EFF has had litigation pending since 2006 involving the phone records program, involving the upstream collection of content. And we've been struggling in the courts because the government has maintained that everything is secret and has refused to basically participate in the litigation other than to claim that it's so secret it has to be dismissed. You know, the documents that Mr. Snowden has released have changed the conversation fundamentally because the government is now admitting what it's doing. Now, it's still defending them, but we're in a very different place than we were before the leaks, even for the information that we already knew. And frankly, most of what has come out so far isn't particularly new. It's that the scope of it and the fact that there are, you know, the government's own documents at issue here mean that the government can no longer pretend, you know, that these things aren't true.
But Cindy Cohen, we had that very close vote in the House recently, and that was essentially would have ended the legal device through which the FISA court has allowed the NSA to do this bulk collection, and that's an interpretation of the Patriot Act. And it gets down to the very question that's also in this release of documents, and these documents have just been declassified. The government talks about a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And the paradox or the inconsistency here is that how could you want to scoop up millions and millions of American citizens' phone calls in this big kind of mega data dump and then troll through it looking for reasonable articulable suspicion, and all this stuff gets stored. So it's essentially saying that every American is a suspect until otherwise disproven.
That's correct. I mean, I think this constitutes something called a general warrant, which you know, a warrant that basically provides only that a crime has been committed, and then lets the law enforcement just, you know, grab documents first and sort out second whether somebody did anything wrong or not. Is, you know, those kind of things are called general warrants or writs of assistance, and they were the basis for the American Revolution. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution was written to prevent these kinds of things, very specifically general warrants and writs of assistance. It's in the history books. So I think it turns our constitutional system on its head. I think that, you know, when we think about the Fourth Amendment, we think about it as our right to be free of search and seizure, right? Well, the government's position is, well, the seizure doesn't matter anymore. They can seize everything, and the only thing that matters is the parameters of their searching. And we think that's inconsistent with the Constitution, and frankly, we think that's inconsistent with how people ought to be able to live in a free country.
So seize first and search later until the facility in Utah is finished, and then all of this, years and years of everybody's phone calls and texts and emails and Facebooks and God knows what else, we'll sort through that. And if you're okay, you're okay. But if you're not, or if you somehow name is confused, I mean, this is a government, by the way, that had a list at the airport after 9/11, which, of course, you know, we just have another anniversary of 9/11. That people like Senator Edward Kennedy would be held up and are not allowed on a plane because they're on a government list. So how can we have confidence that if they can't, you know, if they think a U.S. senator is a terrorist, they must think we're all terrorists?
Well, I don't think we should have confidence at all. And as the revelations come out, there's more and more indications of what you'd expect. I mean, you know, there are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to do this mass surveillance, and you're going to have human beings are how human beings are. And so, you know, we've heard releases of many, many misuses of this information. You know, the NSA even has a term for it. It's called love int, you know, when they've got their analysts who are basically misusing this information in order to spy on their ex-spouses and potential girlfriends and things like that. We've seen misuses for all sorts of things, and we're just beginning to learn about it. So I don't think the American people should have confidence in this at all. I think we need to stop it and go back from scratch and reinstitute rule of law here, which means that the government first has to make a showing that you've done something wrong or that you're somehow affiliated with a terrorist or someone who they're watching with. And once they've made that showing, then they might get access to your communications and communications records. But they don't get to do that first, gather everything in first and only secondarily figure out whether you've done anything wrong, because that just leads to disaster.
But Cindy Cohn, the main revelation that Snowden made, at least the one that came out publicly first in the TV interview that he did in Hong Kong, that was the soundbite, was him saying, sitting at my terminal at Booz Allen Hamilton, which is a contractor for the NSA, sitting at my terminal, I could access the records of anybody, anybody's accountant, even the President of the United States, and I could basically download everything about this person, implying the full scope of searches, what I just referred to as emails, Facebook, phone, text, you name it. And that was so energetically refuted by people like the head of the NSA, General Alexander, and others. And the more we get this stuff dribbling out, the more it becomes apparent that this guy may be telling the truth.
I think, I mean, so far there hasn't been anything that Mr. Snowden has said that has not certainly in the whole, I'm not, you know, I haven't nitpicked through everything the man said, but his documents have all been demonstrated to be truthful documents. The most the government has been able to say is that maybe they're taken out of context in some situations. And, you know, on the other side of this, General Alexander has been revealed to be, I mean, there's no pretty way to say this, to be a liar. He lied to Congress about spying on Americans. They've been playing elaborate word games to try to mislead the American people. Some of them, I think, we're still uncovering. But they plainly aren't telling the truth and aren't being straight with the American people about all the way that they're spying on them. And there's a sharp contrast between, I think, you know, the information that Mr. Snowden's given us, which is largely checked out, and the, you know, shifting sands of defensive and misleading responses that we've gotten from the government. And it's not just General Alexander. I'm sad to report that, you know, President Obama's responses have been just as, I think, misleading to the American people.
So what's your sense then in terms of how much of this metadata they have and the nature of it? Because so far all the government's admitted to is that it uses AT&T and Verizon and these other companies, which they pay handsomely, to basically just collect the time and the phone numbers and the duration of the call, but not the people involved, and then only later will they go through and explore it based upon that notion that they have of reasonable, articulable suspicion. So it seems to me that at this point, as this stuff dribbles out, it seems that they collect an awful lot more than that, and that what Snowden talked about is the ability of just some junior guy sitting at a terminal. If they can check on their girlfriends and their ex-wives, can't they check on the President of the United States?
Well, I think so. And in fact, you know, after the revelations of yesterday, I'm not sure. So there are two different programs that are at issue, or not two different programs. There's two different statutes that the government uses to support what it does. One is the you know, what we call the associational tracking program, or the telephone records that it justifies under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And what we learned yesterday is the idea that they're storing all this stuff and then just searching for it later and only when they've got reasonable articulable suspicion is not true. That's what they got busted for in 2009, which is they were using a very big 18,000 number alert list that did not include, only a small percentage, I think less than 10% of those were people who they had reasonable articular suspicion about, and that they were searching through the data as it went into the database every day for this much, much broader list. That didn't include reasonable articular suspicion. We don't know who was on that list, but certainly it wasn't what they had said to begin with. So their initial story about how this big storage of our telephone records database works just got blown a big hole in it yesterday by what they revealed, and this is what the FISA court is mad at them about. The FISA court said, well, you told us you were only going to do reasonable articular suspicion searches, and that's not even remotely what you've been doing for the last couple of years. So that doesn't appear to be true, certainly as of 2009 and several years before it. You know, how we're doing now, well, we'll have to wait until our FOIA request gets them to cough up what's going on now, but I certainly wouldn't trust what they're saying since it wasn't true before. And then the second program that they're doing is something that they're justifying under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, and that involves content. Now, what they say they're doing there is that they're not really aiming at Americans. They're just accidentally or incidentally collecting the content of American communications on their way to targets that are legitimate targets. But that doesn't make a lot of sense either. We're learning that they went far broader than that assurances, and that does include the content of Americans' communications, and certainly they're collecting the content of Americans' communications. There's a program called the Upstream Program that's reflected in the slides that Mr. Snowden leaked and has been confirmed by some FISA court opinions that were released that demonstrates that they have real-time access to the fiber optic cables. They're making a copy of everything that travels over the fiber optic cables in our telecommunication systems. That's how your stuff travels over the Internet. The content and the metadata both travel over the same fiber optic cables, and we have documents and confirmation from the FISA court that they are basically making a copy of all of that stuff and getting a copy of all of that stuff. One copy goes to your destination, and the other copy goes to the NSA. So that's much, much broader than they'd have you believe. And, you know, we're still getting to the bottom of it. But, you know, it's not, you know, their initial responses and descriptions of how this stuff works are falling apart with each new revelation, and we're not done yet.
Well, Cindy Cohn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Cindy Cohn, who's the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a reporter from the Denver Post about the two Democratic senators who were recalled for their votes on gun control. You say that you're watching me on the telly, seeing me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lynn Bartels, who is a journalist with the Denver Post, who the Washington Post, the Fix blog, named as one of Colorado's best political reporters and tweeters. The Rocky Mountain News hired her in 1993 as its night cop reporter, and in 2000 assigned her to her first legislative session. In 2009, the Denver Post hired Bartels after the Rocky Mountain News closed just shy of its 150th birthday. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lynn Bartels.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm trying to figure out what explains the result of this recall of two Democratic state senators who voted for tighter gun control laws after the gun massacres in Aurora, Colorado, and Newtown, Connecticut. And, of course, all this is happening in the state that's the home of two of the most deadly mass shootings in U.S. history. Can you help us out here?
Sure. It's also a western state. It's an independent state. Colorado is very strange politically. It is almost evenly divided, one-third, 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 among independent voters, Democrats, and Republicans. Traditionally in this state, the unaffiliated voters call the shots. In a very pro-Democratic year, they'll usually vote with the Democrats. In a pro-Republican year, they'll vote with the Republicans. But this is not a state that looks at a lot of gun control. It's the West. There's a lot of hunting. There's a lot of people who've had, you know, firearms in their family for generations.
So what would the urban-rural split be in terms of population? Because that's usually an indicator of those.
Most of the population is definitely, decidedly urban. It's in the Front Range. It's overwhelming. It's called the Front Range, which is, you know, like Denver, the suburbs around it, et cetera. But nonetheless, there's that long Western tradition. And I think it wasn't just gun control, but how it played out at the state capitol.
Explain further, if you will.
Well, for example, in the state Senate, there were 7 bills that were being heard. They scheduled them for all one day. And hundreds of people showed up. And they had to limit the testimony so much because they had, you know, all these bills to hear, that there were hundreds of people who arrived, made long treks from in the southern part of the state or the northern part of the state, and didn't even get to testify. And they were outraged at that, saying, our voices aren't being heard.
And they felt what? That the two senators that were recalled were a part of the problem?
Well, definitely. What's really interesting is if you look at the senators who were called, quite frankly, one lawmaker in the House was the one who sponsored the majority of the gun bills, Representative Rhonda Fields. Her son was murdered. But at the when they were doing this at first, Rhonda is in such a Democratic district that they said, no, we're not even going to attempt it. John Morris is the Senate president. He was recalled. He lives in El Paso County, which is a very Republican county, although he's got more of a Democratic or a mixed, very swing district. But he sponsored a bill that even Democrats publicly said was flat-out nuts, which was this assigning liability for assault weapons to manufacturers and owners, et cetera. He had to withdraw because he didn't even get support from his own caucus. But he withdrew it after it had already been through committee, and so there was all this brain damage over it. Now, what is fascinating about these recalls is that Senator Angela Jaron, a Democrat, both these are Democrats, was recalled. She's from Pueblo, a district that is nearly 50% Democrat, and she got blown out. She lost by 12 percentage points. But Pueblo is not your normal, it's not a liberal Democratic town. It's a union town. It's blue collar. It's hunting. It's recreation with guns. And she really riled up people there. And so what happened was the gun bills were introduced in February. And then everything that was introduced after that was so magnified. Oh, the injustice of it all, this bill and that bill. And then basically Republicans kind of denounced lots of stuff and said, they're not listening to us, they're not listening to us. And that was the mantra.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Lynn Bartels, a journalist with the Denver Post, and we're talking about the recall of two Democratic senators, one of whom was a Senate president, which is being interpreted nationally as a victory for the NRA. And I imagine, given that Democrats are pretty gun-shy about even taking on gun control, and the president forced them into it after the massacre in Newtown, that they're going to be even more gun-shy over this. But in terms of the money that was spent, this
well,
is...
Wait a minute. I wouldn't say that the Senate president forced them into it.
No, I'm saying I'm talking about the president of the United States forced...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
To me, there's only one president here, and that's our state Senate president.
Right.
Yeah, but here's the irony, is Colorado passes this western state. Obama comes out here to say, see if it can be done in Colorado, it can be done anywhere, and then Congress can't even get anything done.
Right. Well, but in terms of the political class interpreting what's happened, for, you know, whether they get it right or not, How do you explain the money issue where the NRA and the supporters of recall were outspent 6-1 by pro-gun control opponents, including Mayor Bloomberg and Los Angeles philanthropist Eli Broud?
Well, it's sometimes easy to look at. I have to say, when it comes to campaign finance, you can kind of make numbers say anything because there's so many groups that don't have to release. And so that you can always say, oh, something's 150 times to one. But the reality is you don't know what some of these groups are spending. I mean, I think one of the strangest things about this whole debate is that Michael Bloomberg personally donated $350,000 to fight the recalls. The outcry, oh, next he's going to come in and take our big gulps away, and this is a New York, you know, an East Coast liberal trying to tell us what to do. Well, the NRA donated $360,000, but they didn't seem to think, you know, tit for tat there. Okay, we're taking money from the NRA. They're taking money from Bloomberg. Shouldn't that cross each other out? But no, it was viewed as Bloomberg once again is trying to tell us what to do in our state.
Well, also, you've got the conservative billionaire Koch brothers who joined in support of this recall with their advocacy group, Americans for Prosperity. But because they're a so-called nonprofit charity, they didn't have to report how much they spent. So I guess
that's the point I'm making. And AFP did tons of calling. Like, you know, they can't do that thing like vote against Angela Heron, vote against John Morris. So it was much more about remember to go vote. But they also did radio ads and mailers talking about some of the more controversial bills passed in the legislature. The reality is in Colorado was that guns lit the fire and then everything else was thrown on top of it. There was a renewable energy bill that so outraged rural Coloradans that combined with gun laws, has a number of counties voting in November whether to secede from the state of Colorado.
Well, it's still, though, pretty hard to understand how people could get so hot and bothered about a bill that limits magazine clips to 15 rounds and requires universal background checks on all firearm sales. It doesn't seem that radical. And I believe the other point is, of course, it's still the law, right?
Correct. I mean, there's the thing. These two were ousted, but the gun laws are there. Here's the biggest irony of all the bills. One of the bills that passed would have basically charged gun customers the cost of performing that background check. Oh, my God, you would have thought it was the end of the world. I'm being charged to exercise my constitutional right. You know the reality? That there was first a fee charged in Colorado when that was first instituted in the 1990s. It was passed by the Republican-controlled legislature and some of the most staunchest gun right activists in the state. Then to save money, Colorado said, let's not have our own background checks. Let's just do the FBI's. Well, the FBI doesn't catch the local restraining orders. There was a terrible tragedy. The state quickly instituted it. But by that time, remember the good times in the late 90s? Colorado had nearly a $1 billion surplus. So they said, there's no need to charge. So when they went back and said, let's charge like we used to when the Republicans were in control, you would have thought it was the end of the world. That was the one I never understood in a million years.
Well, I'm sure you're aware, Lynn Bartles, that this is definitely, whether people are bothering to find out what happened in Colorado or not, this has national implications, doesn't it?
Oh, it has huge,
right.
Huge national implications. And I loved your word, gun shy.
Well, Lynn, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Lynn Bartles, who's a journalist with the Denver Post, who the Washington Post, the Fix blog, named as one of Colorado's best political reporters and tweeters. The Rocky Mountain News hired her in 1993 as its night cops reporter, and in 2000 assigned her to her first legislative session. In 2009, the Denver Post hired Bartles after the Rocky Mountain News closed just shy of its 150th birthday. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the author of a new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East.
It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Anderson, who's a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, El Salvador, and many other strife-torn countries. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Times, has also written for Vanity Fair, Esquire, Harper's Magazine, and Outside. He's the author of Moonlight Hotel, Triage, The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The 4 O'Clock Murders, and co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother John Lee Anderson. His latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Anderson.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure to be here.
And, of course, there's the old adage about those who don't understand the past are doomed to repeat it. And we are, of course, learning lessons, if you will, or we're paralyzed by lessons perhaps mislearned from the Iraq War, the Bush-Cheney-Rice-Rumsfeld folly, which is its shadow is being cast over this current situation with Syria, where most Americans and most of the representatives believe that the deceit over WMD somehow applies to this current situation. But as much as that is affecting the present, what your book brings to the table is the broader canvas where we go back to World War One, and as you say, this was a time when the seeds were planted for the Arab world, in quotes, to define itself less by what it aspires to become than what it is opposed to, colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism in its many forms. So that, I guess, is where the past is really haunting us, right?
That's right. That's right. And I think what we're seeing today throughout the Middle East, and most acutely at the moment in Syria, is really a disintegration of the decisions that were made at the end of World War One, almost a full century ago, in which the region was divided up with artificial borders and carved up between the French and the British empires. I think that's all coming back to haunt us. You mentioned Iraq. I was just reminded of, and I deal with it briefly in my epilogue, but when the British cobbled together Iraq in 1919, T.E. Lawrence and a number of other people who actually knew Iraq warned of what was going to happen. The people who understood the clan and tribal structure there, and on top of that, the idea of putting together a Shia and Sunni and Kurds who were mutually antagonistic was a recipe for disaster. And in fact, it's very rarely remembered, but within months of the British going in, they had a full-scale revolt on their hands in 1920. So certainly you can see parallels. I saw parallels with what happened in 1919-1920 in Iraq with the whole run-up to the Iraq War in 2003.
So in terms of the cobbling together these countries along artificial boundaries and regardless of ethnicity and history, and by the way, just apropos what you just said, it was after all and shortly thereafter the British got bogged down in Iraq in the early 20s that Winston Churchill ordered the use of chemical weapons.
They
gassed the tribesmen.
That's right.
And of course, nowadays the tables are turned. So in terms of artificial lines on a map drawn up by these colonial cartographers, one of whom, of course, is Mark Sykes, who's in your book, who Lawrence of Arabia, T. Lawrence, disdainfully described as a bundle of prejudices, intuitions, and half-sciences.
Right.
He's the guy, along with Picot, the Frenchman, that drew the boundaries that made modern Syria. Now, I understand that there's a Machiavellian element here that came to the fore in Rwanda, where the minority Tutsis were encouraged by both the French and the British colonialists to take power as a minority tribe to rule over majority tribes. And is that the same thinking that went on in Syria, where they decided to put the Alawites in charge, a minority, to oversee a majority?
I mean, not exactly. But what they did in Syria, Greater Syria really consists of what we refer to as Syria today, but also Lebanon, is Palestine or what is Israel today, and Jordan. So it was a vast area, and what the British and French did at the end of the war was they basically carved it into four different countries, and in the process of doing that, cut across tribal lines, clan lines, and particularly in Lebanon, it created something very much like you're talking about. There was a very large Christian, still is a very large Christian population in Lebanon, and so the French, to control matters, came up with this very complicated formula where there would always be a Christian prime minister, while at the same time you had a Muslim president. And just demographically, over time, it became a recipe for civil war. I think what you mentioned, the Machiavellian aspect to it. I think also there was just an element of arrogance based on ignorance, and an element of wishful thinking. You mentioned Mark Sykes, and there's this famous quote of Mark Sykes. He was also, in addition to creating the Sykes-Picot Agreement, or being the co-author of it, which divided up the region, he was also a prime mover of the Balfour Declaration, which paved the way for, encouraged Jewish emigration into Palestine. And he had this quote where he said, you know, I see absolutely no reason why the resident Arab population in Palestine will have any problem with increased Jewish immigration into the area. So there was this very blithe and rather arrogant view of what was going to happen. And if problems did come along, well, European might would solve the problem. And again, I see that wishful thinking playing out today with the American government and certainly under the Bush administration, this idea that, well, of course, people, you know, they want democracy, they want to be liberated. So, we will be treated as liberators.
And that sort of combination of missionary zeal and reckless utopianism from the neoconservatives ended up handing Iraq over to Iran.
That's right. That's
great,
right.
Great job, guys.
Right. Just as an aside, I spent some time with Iraqi refugees in Syria and Jordan a few years ago, and I remember talking to a Ba'athist colonel who's now in exile, and he said he was in Basra, which is in the Shia area of southern Iraq, and he said the day the Americans started the war, Iranian secret police were showing up in Basra and pointing out the people to be executed, and he was according to him he was slated for execution, so that's why he left. But it was instantaneous, and the Americans were utterly blindsided by that.
So back to your new book, Scott Anderson, again, a veteran war correspondent who's reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, and El Salvador, among many other strife-torn countries. He is the co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother, John Lee Anderson, and his latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. And, of course, much of the book centers on Syria, the story of the moment, if you will, but just going back to the Ottomans, arguably that was the last time that the Middle East was stable. And then during World War II, of course, the Germans became allies of the Turks and then made a move on the Suez Canal, and the Brits counterattacked, if you will, via the debacle at Gallipoli, when in fact there was a place right on the Syrian and Turkish border which would have worked a lot better, right? And
that's right.
And that was what? French duplicity?
Yes. Basically, it's called Alexandretta. There's this city today in Turkey called Iskenderun. And it was really the Achilles heel of the Ottoman Empire. It was a spot that was very hard to defend, had a deep water port, which made it perfect for amphibious landings. And every military strategist who in the know, including Lawrence, advocated a landing at Alexandretta. The problem was the French, who couldn't commit any troops at that time to the Middle Eastern theater. Alexandretta bordered right on Syria, and they had already put a claim in for Syria after the war, so they didn't want the British anywhere near Syria. So instead, they advocated a landing at Gallipoli, which, and it, I have to say, if you look at a map of the Ottoman Empire, and I at one point I looked up, I think there's over 3,000 miles of coastline. It would be, I couldn't find a single spot anywhere on that coastline that would make a worse spot for an amphibious landing against entrenched troops than the tip of Gallipoli. And that's exactly where, of course, the British went ashore.
Well, of course, the Australians and New Zealanders paid dearly with 25,000 killed. It was
That's right.
Very poetically shown in that film, Gallipoli. But in terms of the characters in your book, and of course, one of the things that I keep finding all the time as I talk to historians is that history is so often affected almost exclusively, if not dominated, by personalities. As opposed to policies. And you've got some extraordinary personalities here with the German spy in Cairo, Kurt Prüfer. You've got Aaron Aronson, the agronomist and committed Zionist. And then you've got William Yale, the fallen scion of the American aristocratic Yale family. And, of course, you've got T. Lawrence, who later became Lawrence of Arabia.
Right. The fascinating thing about the Middle East during this period of World War One is, of course, the vast majority of fighting and the vast majority of treasure spent and lives lost, certainly for the British and the French, was on the Western Front. So the Ottoman theater of the war was very much an afterthought. As Lawrence said, a sideshow to a sideshow. And the result of that was that people like Lawrence and these other three characters that you mentioned that are the primary characters in the book, they had extraordinary freedom of movement to kind of go out and cause trouble without much adult supervision at all. And I don't think there was another place. There were seven or eight different war theaters in World War One, and I don't think you would have ever found, if Lawrence had gone to one of those other places, he never would have had the freedom of movement that he had there. So what you had, it was this small group of men who, all of whom, one thing they shared was they all have a talent for treachery. They were all brilliant and virtually unsupervised. And so they were thrust into this moment where they were able to effect enormous change on the world stage. And these are men in their 20s and 30s. Lawrence, when the start of the Arab Revolt, when he first went off to Arabia to become the liaison to the Arab rebels, he was 28.
Well, what is extraordinary, though, is that how so many of them had these kind of, you know, manifest destiny kind of dreams. You know, the German, of course, the master spy, was influenced by the Kaiser's idea of that Germany had to have its place in the sun, and essentially an aristocratic squabble amongst the same family resulted in the slaughter of millions of men pointlessly in the so-called Great War. And then you had the American scion from the Yale family working for Standard Oil. And then you've got the Zionist who has equal sort of grand dreams of a Jewish homeland.
Right.
And then you've got this strange paradox that Chaim Weizmann's sister is working for the Germans.
Right. It was a great little detail I came across that her name was Minna Weizmann. And she was definitely the black sheep of the Weizmann family. It was a very large family from Russia. And she was committed Bolshevik. And of course, for any left-leaning Jew, the idea of going into an alliance where this was when Tsarist Russia was still around, Tsarist Russia was virulently anti-Semitic. So a lot of Jews, including American Jews and even English Jews, were incredibly ambivalent about the war. And if they sided with anybody, it was towards Germany. And so Minna Weizmann met Kurt Prüfer in Jerusalem and by all accounts became his lover. And Kurt Prüfer figured out that a great way to spy on the British in Egypt was to recruit Jews who were leaving Palestine. They were being given free passage out, and a lot of them were ending up in Egypt. So he actually sent his Minna Weitzman to Cairo as a German spy, and she got uncovered there. And under very mysterious circumstances, possibly because of her brother Chaim Weizmann, who was very powerful in England, managed to escape being put in front of a firing squad.
Right, and he Chaim Weizmann, because became Israel's first president.
That's right. And never mentioned his younger sister in his. He wrote about a 600-page autobiography, and somehow never got around to mentioning his youngest sister.
Well, I just find, particularly in the case of the German spy, who even he knew that the Turkish attack on the Suez Canal was a folly, but nevertheless encouraged them. And of course, Lawrence, as the movie shows, did the famous counterattack. But the idea that Prüfer was using Islamic radicalism against the British Empire and against the British is so extraordinary, how, as a device that, of course, was used by the Dulles brothers against
right.
Arab socialism in the 50s and 60s. The mosques were deserted in those days, and they stirred up Islam in order to fight communism or socialism, culminating right. with what happened in Afghanistan in the Reagan administration, which, of course, created the blowback eventually of Osama bin Laden. So
right.
Talk about history repeating itself.
Yeah, it always seems like a kind of boomerang back. You're right. The Germans came up with the idea of how do you fight the British and French empires in abroad, the outside of Europe? And the Germans came up with the idea because they were the one European power that did not have any Muslim vassal states, and the Muslim states like in Egypt and in the French case Morocco and Tunisia, were bitterly resentful of their imperial overlords, and so the Germans came up with this idea of spreading jihad, of stoking an Islamic jihad that would rebel against their imperial enemies in the Middle East.
So just back to the current situation where Syria is the focus, and your earlier observation about how Arab states are more reactive in the sense that they're reacting against colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism as opposed to having a definition for themselves. And of course now, since the Arab Spring, there is obviously enormous turmoil, not the least of which is the very religious sectarian split between Shiism and Sunnism is being exacerbated in Syria, and it may end up exploding in a regional war. So what's your sense then of the role, because at the moment a lot of the rejection of Obama's war resolution on the left comes out of an anti-imperialism and a fatigue of intervention, if you will.
Right.
So that seems to be what's sort of governing us now, and it's an ironic moment, is it not?
It is. And getting to the point about the way that Arab society rather defines itself by what it's opposed to rather than what it strives for. As you've mentioned, I've covered wars in around the world, and the one thing I've always been struck by in the Arab world is that you talk to fighters and you ask what they're fighting for. In other parts of the world, they give an idea of what they're fighting for. I mean, it could be very naive, a socialist utopia or whatever, and almost always in the Arab world, the answer is not what they're fighting for, but what they're fighting against. And I think that has played out for the last century throughout the Middle East. And so you now have a society that largely defines itself by that, what it is opposed to. And in particular with Syria, I mean, I think the great danger, as I said earlier, I think what we're seeing now is the final disintegration of those borders of the whole status quo that was created a century ago, and we've already seen it in Iraq. I mean, no American government official is going to admit it, but today Iraq is essentially three countries. So is Libya. Libya has reverted largely to the autonomous zones that were created by the Ottomans 100 years ago. And so in Syria, I think the danger of going in And I'm just on a personal level, I'm not completely opposed to it. I think perhaps the United States needs to do something in response to what Bashar Assad has done. But I think the danger is that you actually end up empowering him. I think there's maybe a part of Bashar who they would love to have a limited, I forget how Kerry described it, you know, extremely small airstrike against
yes.
him. Because that
no,
would
an incredibly, incredibly
and it
small.
Helps
yeah.
paint his opposition as lackeys of the Americans.
Right.
So, there's really no easy way in or out of all this stuff.
Well, but the irony is, of course, is that in the sweep of history, it's the Mubarak's and the Saddam Hussein's and the Assad's who are in many ways, particularly in the case of, you know, the Israelis, actually, they're perfectly happy with Assad, and much of the opposition to him, the ones that we now are afraid of, are the ones that point this out, you know.
So, yeah.
And you see what happened with Mubarak. I mean, he was Israel's favorite, and now they've managed, you know, to sort of bring him back or bring his ghost back.
Right. So, right. Yeah. I mean, I think the Israelis sort of operate on the level at this point of, you know, better the devil you know.
Right.
With all their neighbors and upheaval, you just don't know where this thing is going, and obviously Syria is careening out of control, has careened out of control, and you don't know. I think it's going to be a long time before what the end result is going to be. It could be a fractured country. It could be that Bashar carves out a mini Syria. It takes the Alawite community and perhaps the Christian community with him. So you may have a new nation, and it's just utterly unpredictable where it's all going. And whether the United States involves itself militarily or does the opposite. I think the thing that's fascinating at this moment is that I just don't think either side in this debate can say with a straight face what they think is going to happen or where it might lead, whether it's intervention or non-intervention. I think it's just a crazy roller coaster ride.
Well, Scott Anderson, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East.
Thank you so much, Ian. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Anderson, a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, El Salvador, and many other strife-torn countries. He's the author of Moonlight Hotel, Triage, The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The 4 o'clock Murders, and he's co-author of War Zones and Inside the League with his brother John Lee Anderson. And his latest book just out is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.